Welcome to Smart Talk. I'm Scott Lamar, broadcasting from my home studio. The Pennsylvania Department of Health reported 510 new cases of COVID-19 in the 24-hour period ending at midnight yesterday. 38 people died during that time from the virus. The state has recorded 82,696 positive COVID cases and 6,464 deaths. The state releases daily updates on the number of positive COVID-19 cases and how many people have died from the virus. However, a Spotlight PA report finds that there have been inconsistencies in the data, and without context, the numbers don't provide solid information needed to track COVID-19. The reporter who investigated this case is Spotlight PA reporter Sarah Simon. Sarah Simon, welcome to the program.
Hi, thanks for having me.
If you have a question or a comment, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. You can leave a question or a comment on WITF's Facebook page. On Twitter, we are at SmartTalk, WITF. Again, the phone number, 1-800-729-7532. Sarah Simon, do we know if those numbers that I just quoted from yesterday are accurate?
You know what, Scott? I want to believe that they are, and I think that's the most important takeaway from all this, right? I have not found any, and I've been digging. I have not found any intentional manipulation of the numbers.
Hey, Sarah. Sarah, we got a real bad phone line. So how about we call you back? We're going to call you right back. Okay. All right, we'll call. Hang up, and we'll call you right back. This is, folks, as you have heard over the past 2 months, I'm broadcasting from my home studio, which also doubles as my basement. It was my basement before it was my home studio. But as everyone else is talking to us from their homes, maybe from their offices, we do run into these things where we have bad phone lines from time to time. And this is one of those occasions where I think that we only could make out half of what Sarah was saying there. And so we want to make sure that we have a good line going into this. But, yeah, one of the things that you – and by the way, this report from Spotlight PA, as we do whenever we have one of these journalists appearing on the program, there is – a link to her story, Sarah's story, which was published last week in Spotlight PA and PA Post. There is a link on our website, WITF.org, today's Smart Talk story, a link to Sarah. Sarah, are you there?
I'm here. Can you hear me?
Yes, that sounds much better.
Is that
okay.
Better?
That
Sorry about that. I was trying to use my Wi-Fi.
Okay, so let me ask you that question again, because I think we got about half of your answer. But
sure,
those numbers that I quoted from yesterday, are they accurate?
Here's my response to that. I really want to believe that they are. And in all of my reporting, you know, I'm an investigative data reporter. I've been digging into the state's numbers. It's important for the public to know I have not found any intentional manipulation. But that being said, I think there's been many instances where context has been missing. And especially when there's context missing, it makes me question what's not being shown, right? I think there's this kind of universal understanding about data that there's kind of inherent truth in it. And I think that people who, you know, in talking with experts and talking with researchers and talking with academics and talking with statisticians, people who work with numbers daily know that numbers don't always tell the whole story. And I think what I'm finding in reporting on Pennsylvania's COVID-19 numbers is that sometimes they don't totally tell the whole story. And then when people try to ask questions, the responses that we get, the justifications that we get, the answers that we get for why pieces are missing or why explanations are missing aren't totally true. And so, you know, in journalism, we talk about trust but verify. I trust that the numbers are accurate, but I'm having a really hard time trying to verify them. That's what my story's about.
Well, I have to say that when you say trust and verify, you trust that the numbers are right. But when you find that there isn't context or there may be inconsistencies in these numbers, it may be hard for the public to trust, and not just the public, but others who use these numbers. What's missing? Let's start with that. You said that one of the things that you found is there was a lot missing. What's missing?
Sure. I think what's maybe most important that's missing is context about when what the descriptions about what numbers mean and when they change. And so, for example, I found a lot of cases, you know, I look at these numbers every day very closely, and sometimes I've caught a simple error, which, you know, again, I don't think that's manipulation. I don't think that's intentional, but it's an accident. You know, this fast-moving data, this is really complicated. Everybody knows this is going to be hard. So they go and fix their error, but then there's no disclosure about that, right? And the problem with that is that in many cases all across the state and in fact all across the country, there are people looking closely at these numbers. And if you happen to catch it once and you say, you know, maybe pull the numbers into your own spreadsheet and calculate your numbers in your calculations there, but then you don't catch that an hour later a number changed. If there's no disclosure about what happened when, about why something changed, about, oops, you know, we just caught this error, then that can make it really hard to, you know, looking back, we're now more than 3 months after the start of the crisis, it can be really difficult to catch accurate patterns and trends if you're not totally confident that what you have is exactly, you know, is the accurate version of it. I've also found the same kind of questions about, you know, that's about specific numbers. I found the same kinds of questions about methodologies and sources, you know, where these numbers are even coming from. And I think a big point here that, you know, there's been a lot of reporting about, maybe not enough too, about the missing data about race and ethnicity in COVID-19 case numbers in Pennsylvania. And in talking with, you know, folks who use this data across the state, an interesting point that was made to me is that okay, we're missing this information already for more than half of now what's more than 80,000 cases, but the numbers that we do have, we don't really know much about them, right? Where does that race information come from? How is that being collected? Is it being collected in the same way all across the state? There are just gaps in our understanding about how this data is being collected that when you put them together, when you look at the big picture, it just really raise a lot of questions about what we know and more importantly, what we still don't know.
There's so many questions I have after just hearing what you had to say, Sarah, but how and who is using this data?
Sure, it's a lot of academics. You know, it's a lot of epidemiologists and public health. It's a lot of academics trying to understand how do we respond immediately in this moment. You know, where are the places that who's in the communities that need help right now? Where are the hospitals that are going to be facing crowded spaces pretty soon? It's both an immediate question and a bigger picture question, right? Like I'm thinking about the people who are going to be studying this years from now. And that's why this is so important for me, you know, in this, yes, it's important in this moment to make sure that the resources are going to the people who need it ASAP. But it's also important as we think about how do we learn from this years in the future? How do we know, okay, did we make the right call in this situation? You know, did the state make the right call in this situation? Did the state respond appropriately? How do we make this decision that we came to if we don't have an accurate account of what happened when and specifically why decisions were made when? We won't be able to accurately learn from this crisis. And you know, we know public experts know that the coronavirus, COVID-19, is just one of many coronaviruses. You know, meanwhile, there's all sorts of other you know, other potential crises that could happen. If we don't take this opportunity to learn from how the state is handling this crisis, that might inhibit our efforts moving forward with the next one.
You know, I have to admit that thinking historically, 100 years ago, the Spanish flu epidemic in 1918, that you see figures of the number of deaths from 150 to 200 million people. And, okay, now that was 112 years ago. That 50 million disparity, I mean, that's a big disparity. You would think that with the technology that we have today, it would be much easier to narrow these things down. But apparently it's not.
Apparently it's not. I mean, this is complicated. And I do, you know, every expert I talked to prefaced our conversations with exactly that. Like, this is complicated. We are all in uncharted waters. This is totally a new territory for the 21st century. We don't know the best way to handle this response. But that being said, and again, this is the thrust of my story, there were steps that the state could have taken to safeguard trust in this data, and those steps did not happen. The other thing I wanted to raise too, you know, why I think this is so important to get right. We know that the coronavirus, regardless of the race data that's missing, we know that the coronavirus is impacting communities of color, vulnerable populations harder than most. We know that those disparities are there. And I think, I've been especially focused on the death numbers. To me, it's crucial that it's crucial that we build an accurate death toll to honor these lives. If we could not protect them while these people were living, I think it's important that we make sure that their deaths are represented accurately. And the systems, you know, I mentioned this in my story, the state's kind of patchwork of multiple death reporting systems, and that led to, you know, a lot of confusion in the numbers. There were big spikes. There was a drop. There was one day when there were 200 deaths removed from the count. Still, you know, there's a lot of talk about data reconciliation. That's the process of merging and vetting data that's being, you know, coming in from different places. That effort is still ongoing. You know, just yesterday, in the 38 deaths that were added to Pennsylvania's state count yesterday, one of them was from April. Two of them maybe from May, and then the rest were from June. So this effort is still ongoing, and I think that's another question I have about the data is how do we know when the death, when the data reconciliation is slowing down? How do we know when the death toll is slowing down, or when the reconciliation is just done? You know, the state has not been clear about how many of these deaths that they know about from COVID-19 are still yet to be included in the count.
You know, and then what you just said makes me provide a correction to my introduction. When I said that...
I missed it because I think my phone was...
well, the state... I said that the state had reported 38 new deaths during the 24-hour period. And that's not accurate. If there are a couple deaths from April and from May, then that's not accurate. It was just that...
I think it gets into the question of semantics here, right? They newly reported 38 deaths.
Those
deaths did not occur overnight. And I think they have been clear about that. You know, there are some lags in reporting. That's inevitable with any situation, especially in a global pandemic. But I think maybe what's missing is that context of just how long these lags are playing out.
We're going to talk more about this in just a moment. You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. Welcome back to Smart Talk. Our guest during this portion of the program is Spotlight PA reporter Sarah Simon. Her story last week really hit on some of the inconsistencies of the data being reported by the state, the Department of Health, when it comes to COVID-19 cases and deaths in particular. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. On Twitter, we are at smarttalkwitf. Again, the phone number, 1-800-729-7532. Sarah, you talked about some of the inconsistencies in deaths that have been reported. County coroners, all along, there have been a number of county coroners that have different numbers than the state. Why?
Yep. So that's kind of a multi-pronged answer here. The explanation that the state has been given is that county coroners serve a different jurisdiction than the way that the state is reporting COVID-19 deaths. So county coroners, and there's the majority of Pennsylvania counties have a county coroner, and then there's a handful of counties that have a medical examiner. For the sake of this conversation, you can think of those as the same kind of role, right? The role of the coroner is to investigate deaths that occur within their county. And the way that's different than the way that Pennsylvania is reporting COVID-19 deaths, and I think it's important they would want me to say that the CDC requires that COVID-19 deaths are reported for the county of residence. And so that's why that was the state's kind of explanation at the start of this confusion. You know, I first reported on the frustrations of the county coroners back in April, and when my story ran in April, that I know that the Pennsylvania Coroners Association have been having these conversations, you know, weeks of conversations with the state. So this is, you know, this has been going on since probably mid beginning of March, raising these concerns. So the state's explanation is that, well, the jurisdiction is different, right? Say somebody dies in one county, say somebody dies in Dauphin County, but their place of residence was Cumberland County. They'll be reported for Cumberland County, and that might cause some confusion. And the other piece of this puzzle is that in the midst of this pandemic, Pennsylvania switched to a new different kind of electronic death registration system. And many people were not, and many people who certify deaths, right? That's the coroners, that's the medical examiners, that's frontline physicians in hospitals and nursing homes, that's the funeral directors who are working with the, you know, all the death paperwork. Many people were not trained on this technology. And so kind of the that whole rollout, the decision to start mandating use of that death reporting system also contributed to a lot of the confusion.
You know, the nursing home data was also something that was confusing to many people. When nursing home data was released, it was contested right away. It was a good example of why that data is important. I mean, if my mother or father is residing in a facility that has a significant number of cases, I want to make sure steps are being taken to keep them safe. At the same time, there's the reputation and standing of the facility. Has that data become any more accurate? And why was there confusion to begin with?
So the last I looked into this, which was, you know, a few weeks ago, I had some conversations about this with folks who have initially questioned the first release of the data, and they have not yet been resolved. So I want to caveat this by saying that I haven't been following it closely, but my understanding is that, no, there's still a lot of issues with the nursing home data. And in fact, my big question, when the nursing home data and the long-term care facility data was originally released, there was a really there was no disclaimer on the data, and people started, you know, again, as you mentioned, immediately challenging it, immediately asking questions. Eventually, the state started quietly correcting the numbers, right, without kind of disclosure about what they were editing. But they also then tacked a pretty lengthy disclaimer to the top of the file where the data exists. And, you know, it was really fine print. It was really, really long. And I had a lot of questions about that disclaimer. And so those questions, but here, I'll give you an example. One of the very last lines of that original disclaimer that I should say is no longer on the nursing home data, they mentioned that to avoid the risk of a double count, staff who worked at multiple facilities would only be counted for one. Now, if you step back and think, okay, double count, in, when you're trying to, you know, count data, the risk of a double count is bad. But when you step back and think, well, what is the point of this data? What is this data trying to elucidate? I don't care about risking a double count. That's exactly what I want to know, right? I want to know which staff members at which facilities are also working at other facilities. I don't want to not count them for one facility. I want to see those intersections, and that is missing. We just don't have that context of staff members who are going back and forth between multiple facilities. When I asked the Department of Health about this, they said, well, that's just how our systems work. You know, their systems, you know, a staff member has lists of primary facility that they, you know, they work at most of the time, and so their other facilities aren't being counted. So I did look this morning because I wanted to be prepared when I talked about this. That disclaimer on the original data is gone. There are some disclaimers later on outside of the Excel file where the data exists on the page where the state publishes their long-term care facility data. And there is a little star that says, you know, this report does not capture all Philadelphia County long-term care facility. So, you know, I don't know. There's just a lot of questions kind of still circling about. Again, my questions aren't what data is included. It's what's not. It's what's missing. It's let's find the holes, and how does that kind of prohibit us from getting the full picture?
Hey, Sarah, can I ask you to pull your phone back a little bit further from your mouth?
Oh, sorry.
Okay.
I'm getting a little heated.
That's all right. We like passion. Let's take a phone call. Let's take a phone call from Joel. Joel, you're on the air.
Good morning.
Good morning.
How are you, Scott?
I'm doing well.
My observation, I'm a data guy myself, and my observation is that it seems that over the course of the last several months, the format of the data continues to change. The content continues to change. Information comes and goes. And it's in a format that's virtually impossible for anybody who loves data to analyze. So my suggestion to the state is to use the Department of Education's website as an example. They load it up with spreadsheets. They're easily downloaded. They're consistently formatted. And they put data in a detailed format. For me, the first rule of analysis is that I can build summaries from detail, but I cannot get detail from summaries. So the more detail, the better. And in terms of the cost of doing this, it's minimal. It takes the data in the fashion that they collect it and doesn't require them to do any summaries at all, frankly.
Hey, Joel, thank you very much for your call and for your observations. Sarah, you kind of touch on something that Joel discusses there in that you quoted someone, another data person, who said that if I have 3 hours and it takes me two to figure out what the source is, or, you know, to talk about what Joel just brought up. Did you find those things as well?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, we were talking about the long-term care facility data, and that's kind of an outline, and that's published in the form of an Excel spreadsheet. I'll say, though, it hasn't always been that way. Originally, it was an Excel spreadsheet, and then they changed it to a PDF file, and then I asked a lot of questions about that, and they changed it back to an Excel spreadsheet. The format that data is published in is important because, as I mentioned in my story, it sets the stage for what the public can do with it. I was trying to think of a good analogy for this, and I haven't yet. Listeners, if you have one, please write in and let me know. But essentially, it's being able to copy-paste numbers from website. You shouldn't even have to do that, but you can't with the state's numbers. It's being able to provide data in a way that makes it easy for people to work with and to spot trends. That's something I heard pretty often while reporting this story, was that the state's dashboard that they just published a few weeks ago, I think it came out June 8th, makes it really difficult to see trends over time. And so now, I know a lot of people who are doing this work manually before the dashboard was launched, because every day, a table was published on the state's website. You could either scrape that electronically, that means kind of writing computer code to pull the numbers straight into kind of your own spreadsheet, or you could just do a simple copy-paste if the website allowed for it. But with the new dashboard, you can't even, without a kind of precise and robust understanding of how the internet works and how you can kind of get into the system and pull to extract those numbers, you can't see how things are changing over time. And I think, again, this goes to the bigger question of, what is the purpose of this data? What is it trying to do? What is it trying to explain? What answers are we trying to get from it? And if we can't easily see how things are changing over time, I think that's a problem.
Here's a comment from a listener, and I think we all have heard this. There have been allegations that any death at all in hospitals and nursing homes was categorized as a COVID-related death so that the facility gets federal dollars. If this is the case, then how can we believe any numbers? Did you look into that at all in your story?
I don't have the specifics on what I'm doing. I did a lot of reporting on what are referred to as probable deaths, and kind of looking into the CDC's guidance of when to count a death as COVID and when not to. There's still a lot of questions about that. What I do know is that probable deaths are included in Pennsylvania's death count. But the big question I have with that is, they weren't always, there were some kinds of probable cases, but not others. Then with the switch to the new death reporting system, the state became kind of in line, is what they told me, with CDC guidance of how to count probable deaths. The big question I have is that the state very easily and clearly in their data provides a breakdown of the differences between confirmed and probable cases, that's living people with COVID-19. They don't do the same with deaths. And so I think it's really kind of confusing if you're trying to understand the death numbers. You just see one number, and it's one big number. And I know, because I've done the reporting, that it encompasses all different kinds. You know, there's the confirmed COVID-19 cases, the probable COVID-19 deaths, but I don't yet have a breakdown of how many of those we're talking about, and that makes it really difficult to kind of understand how hospitals are handling these.
50 cases per 100,000 people was Governor Wolf's marker for counties moving from red to yellow to green, but that marker wasn't adhered to. This was something that, as you reported, that was a figure that a lot of people kind of latched onto is, okay, we got to get to that 50 per 100,000 number. But then there were some inconsistencies that developed there. Talk about that. That seemed to be some data that people could understand easily.
Sure. And I think it's important to talk about, because Governor Wolf did say from the start when he introduced this metric, he did say it would be one of many metrics. I think what happened with this situation is that it was the only metric that the public could easily vet with the data that was available. And that's why people latched onto it, right? It was an easy number to remember, 50 new cases over the past 14 days per 100,000 people in the population. It was the only one that you or me or an academic or researcher or a technical tinker or a hobbyist, it was the only one that people could actually crunch the numbers themselves and see, does my county meet this metric? So I looked this morning to see kind of where, with just about the entire state moving to already in green or moving to green soon, one exception. But I looked this morning to see where counties fall on that metric that has since been abandoned. And there are 13 counties that are either at 50 or above it, some significantly above it. I think probably what happened here is that as the state's understanding of COVID-19 evolved, as the state's understanding of their testing capabilities evolved, that metric probably shifted. That's what they've said. But there hasn't really been any clarity on why that happened. There has not, to my knowledge, been a new metric that has been established. And the result of that, the consequence of that, what that means is that people who have been crunching these numbers, or people who just that haven't been and just want to know, how's my county doing, don't really have a way to understand why decisions are made. Why is my county moving into green? Why is my county in green already when I'm looking at the numbers and not see, questions like that circle when there's not kind of clear, a clear messaging on why decisions are being made. It leaves room, opens the space for a lot of questions.
So, final question for you, Sarah. How can the data be improved?
Sure. I think it's what our caller a while ago mentioned exactly. It's making data accessible in ways that people can scrutinize it, that people can vet it, and people can have to build their own trust in the data. I think probably historically there's been reluctance to open data from government. That's the term, open data, when we talk about this kind of thing. I think there's been reluctance because there's kind of an outdated, I would say, mentality that it's too easy to manipulate, right? Like, it would be too easy if the state just released all of these numbers with all of this context, it would crowd the floor. It would be really overwhelming, and it would be too easy for bad actors to go in and make some grasp and manipulate and skew the public's perception of what's happening. I think swinging the pendulum too far the other way and not being clear about the numbers and not providing them in a way that's easy for people to work with, I think only fuels the kind of belief maybe that there are legitimate questions to ask about these, and why can't we get that answer, and why don't we know that, and why can't I see that data, and why can't I see the breakdown of probable and confirmed COVID-19 deaths? There's going to be a balance between making data accessible and making sure that what's put out there is accurate, is verified. But I think that what the state could do and what other states are doing is really being much more thoughtful about what is the purpose of this data, what does it mean, what does it not, how do we communicate that clearly so that the public can make sense of the very confusing time that we're living in.
Spotlight PA reporter Sarah Simon. Sarah, thank you very much for being with us and doing this report. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Scott. I appreciate it.
And as I said earlier, you can there's a link to Sarah's story. You can see Sarah's story on our website, WITF.org/smarttalk. Today's description of today's program, today's web article, there is a link to Sarah's story, and I encourage you to read that. A lot of good information there. You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. Welcome back to Smart Talk. With summer in full swing and restrictions easing, many people are planning trips and travel. But during the COVID-19 pandemic and with the number of cases rising in some places, where is it safe to travel to and how can you travel safely? Joining us on this portion of the program is Craig Haberle, who is a certified travel consultant with Central Penn AAA. Craig, always good to talk with you.
Great to be back on air with you, Scott. Thank you.
Also joining us today is Ashley Ritter. She's a nurse practitioner and postdoctoral fellow at the University of Pennsylvania School of Nursing, also a PhD. Dr. Ritter, thank you very much for being with us today.
Happy to join you this morning.
If you have a question or a comment about travel, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. You can leave a question or a comment on WITF's Facebook page, on Twitter. We are at smarttalkwitf. Again, that phone number, 1-800-729-7532. Craig Haberle, I'll start with you. People have been in the house for more than 3 months now. They want to get out. Will they travel?
Well, that is a great question to ask at this time. Will they travel or do they want to travel? I think people really want to travel. They're ready to get out and explore the wonderful world, whether it's nearby or far away. The question remains what restrictions may be in place that might hinder the ease of travel that we've all experienced in the past. So those are the things that we need to consider when planning ahead. And I use that word planning ahead really as the most important thing so that you can have smart travel and stay safe and healthy.
And that's what we're going to be talking about throughout this segment of the program. I saw a poll yesterday from Temple University that said that the people who responded to this poll said they are more likely to travel closer to home this summer. I'm sure you're aware of many people saying that. What do they mean by closer to home?
Well, of course, a lot of people feel very comfortable with traveling in their own vehicle at this point. It's a controlled environment. They have fewer touch points with outside environments. But really, along the way, we need to think about and plan ahead, even if we're just driving nearby, whether that be in the central Pennsylvania region or to Philadelphia or up to the Poconos or wherever it happens to be that's an easy driving destination. So planning ahead, just make sure that people call ahead or check websites to make sure that the intended destinations are indeed open. We might think that a particular park or an attraction is open, or we've heard from friends, oh, I think such and such is open. But really is important to check websites, call in advance, do your homework, and be well prepared so that you can indeed have the fun you're looking forward to in your travel.
Okay, Craig, so say I'm traveling 200 miles from home in my car. I get your point of being prepared. Just traveling those 200 miles in the car takes some preparation as well. In what way?
Well, absolutely. First of all, after making the call ahead to make sure that your trip is worth going to, that things will be open, it's good to think about if you're traveling your car, having all your personal protective equipment with you, because a lot of places will be requiring masks and perhaps gloves. You'll also want to have your own cleaning supplies with you, hand sanitizer. If you're going to be away for a while, you may even want to bring your own thermometer to make sure that everyone is staying healthy who's traveling along. So as you're going along, you might need to refuel your car. So the first suggestion is fully fuel your vehicle before you depart from home. That's to eliminate one more stop and one more touch point. If you don't have gloves with you, maybe just a plastic bag can slip over your hand when you're using the fuel pump. Extra snacks, that sort of thing, because you may find that restaurants are not closed or is not as easily available to you. Rest stops, restrooms, that sort of thing. Make sure that you bring along protective wear for that sort of thing. Of course, always washing your hands along the way. And even back to the restaurant's point, they may have reduced table capacity. So you might think, oh, I know that restaurant's open. My friend told me it's open, but you might get there and it could be a long line. So it's a good idea to bring along a picnic or some snacks to make sure you don't go hungry. And if you're staying at a hotel, make sure you call them in advance to make sure they're still operating. They might have a change in their check-in procedures or how they do things in regard to the breakfast that might be included. It might not long may no longer be included because often those are buffets. So that sort of thing, make sure you're well-rested before you hit the road, not only from the standpoint of driving safety, but so that you stay healthy along the way. Some people will rent cars to take the longer trip because they want to use something that maybe is more fuel efficient or is newer, more reliable than the car that they usually drive. So a lot of the rental car companies are really doing a wonderful job with an enhanced sanitation measures to clean the cars and have fewer touch points with any of their staff, so you feel comfortable that way too.
Dr. Ritter, Craig touched on a lot there of how you should prepare. But from a standpoint of keeping yourself safe, I mean, he had a lot of preparations there, but specifically of a standpoint of keeping yourself safe, say you're driving, what things can you do to make sure that you are not coming into contact or not being exposed to the COVID-19 virus?
I think what's most important is, even more important than the interactions that take place on our trip, is where we are traveling, considering what transmission looks like in those areas, not just in our final destination, but along the way, and who we're going to come in contact with during that travel. So, you know, if you're traveling to a place that has had rapid increase in the number of infections, your risk of contracting that infection along the way and once you get to your destination is higher. And so I think really thinking critically about where you might go and where you might want to avoid, and I think Craig's point about staying close to home, in the state that you currently live in, you know, or you would likely know the restrictions and the how spread is happening at a better level than if you were to travel somewhere else, that the guidelines, restrictions may be different, and you may not be as aware of the conditions and what you can and cannot do. And so I do think sticking closer to home might be a better approach to travel this summer.
You know,
now, as you're traveling, go ahead.
No, you go ahead.
As you travel along the way, making those modifications to your planning, specifically around meals, stopping and taking breaks, you know, the more places you have interactions, the more likely you're to come in contact with a virus.
You know, but even when you're talking about staying in state, but even from county to county, there are changes.
You're absolutely right.
I mean, for example, I'm thinking about, you know, I went to school in Philadelphia. Love traveling to Philadelphia for sports, for the history, for, you know, the restaurants, everything else. But Philadelphia has a higher infection rate than many of the counties here in central Pennsylvania. So our last segment, we were talking about data and how it is difficult to interpret. How is someone who's traveling what can they base it on when they look at, say, the counties they'll be traveling through and say, Delaware County has the highest infection rate in the state. I'm going to be traveling through Delaware County. Should I be stopping in Delaware County? I guess I'm asking a question of, it seems like it may be a bit of a challenge for travelers to figure out what's safe, where safe, and where isn't.
Well, you make Scott, a great point.
Yeah, go ahead. Go ahead,
and, I work with a collective of PhD-trained researchers, both clinicians, public health experts, with a partnership called Dear Pandemic. And we've created an acronym around how to look at activities in areas that are safer. I think that the conversation this summer is not what is safe, it's how to reduce our risk in the places that we choose to go. So choosing places that there is the ability to have space around you. So this might not be the best time to travel to a big city where you may need to travel up and down an elevator with multiple floors. It might be a better time to travel to a space where you can not be within crowds and have space around you. You want to looking at opportunities to be outside as opposed to indoor environments, and really thinking about who's going to be surrounding you. Within, you're absolutely right that within individual states, the transmission is different, and there's some areas that have higher rates of infection. I think minimizing any situation where you're going to be in close proximity to other people is your best bet. Within state and moving without outside of the state.
Mm-hmm. Craig, what were we going to add?
I was going to say there actually is a CDC COVID-19 data tracker. Now, the earlier segment that Sarah was talking about, you know, some of that information might not be so easy to interpret, but I have been on that website, and it actually shows little dots and places where it's higher incidence of recent outbreaks or concern. It might be good for folks to take a look at that. That's something they can do online and as they proceed along the trip. I think Ashley makes a good point on a general sense to choose to do things that offer more space, more opportunities to stay away from crowds, as attractive as the usual summer going to the theme park. Sounds like a lot of fun. Maybe this isn't the best time to do that. Understanding also that some of those facilities have very limited activities going on at this point. So maybe it's better to wait to do that when things are safer and healthier.
Mm-hmm. We have a question here, and Dr. Ritter, I'm going to put this to you. Linda from Lancaster asks, I'm a 72-year-old woman of no additional risk. I'm flying to Denver next month. What are good practices in the airport?
That's a great question, Linda. So the airport, and again, all the places you interact with from your home to the airport, such as the transport in maybe a rideshare or public transportation to get to the airport. As with all environments, you want to ensure that you are wearing a mask, that your hands have been washed, and that you're sanitizing any surfaces that you're going to touch, and both before and after you come in contact with those surfaces. I would touch base with the airline prior to your travel to see what the seating features are. Many airlines are closing seats every other row or not selling the center seat so that you have the ability to have a bit more space during your air travel. And they're requiring you to wear a mask, so you should plan to have a mask on the duration of your air travel. In addition, packing your own food may be a really good plan, especially if you have dietary restrictions. The opportunities for food, both in flight and in the airport, may be different, and there's the chance that there might be delays with less resources in the airport. So it's important to plan hope for the best, but plan for delays and the ability to self-sustain and keep the area around you disinfected.
Correct.
Scott,
we have
add one thing to that, if I might.
Yeah, go ahead.
There's a recent ruling from TSA. Instead of the usual very limited 3 ounces that you're allowed of any fluid to take through security clearance. They have now just recently increased that to a 12 ounces for hand sanitizers. So that is giving us much greater opportunity to keep our hands clean with a hand sanitizer. Again, that's been increased to 12 ounces, which should sustain people throughout the course of the trip. And, of course, the wipes that you may want to use on the arms and the tables of the aircraft for Linda's flight to Denver and back would be a good idea. Even though the airlines are instituting greatly increased hygiene practices, it's still nice to know that it really has been done to your satisfaction.
Craig, I'm going to put this one to you. This is from our listener, Ron, who says, I'm to leave on a trip to Malta via Zurich on August 21st and return back to the U.S. on September 19th via an overnight stay in Frankfurt. What type of travel restrictions should I expect?
Well, that really gets complicated because Ron is traveling through multiple countries, changing planes, staying overnight. The best thing to do for him to do is to, as Ashley said, check with the airlines about their restrictions since he'll be flying. It's also very important to check with the Department of State to be certain that, as a U.S. citizen, which I assume Ron is, that they are accepting travelers coming back from Malta or any other destination.
Can I interrupt for just one second,
yes.
Craig? There was
yes.
a story this morning, just this morning, that the European Union says it may not accept travelers coming from the U.S. because the United States has such a high number of COVID-19 cases. Now, that is not official yet, and that is may not take travelers, but that's something else that could enter into this.
Exactly, and I'm glad you brought up that article, which I've been following. Some of that is, based on the reality that the U.S. has not done as good a job as many other places in restricting the growth of the outbreaks. But also, some of that's a little bit political, a little bit of tit for tat. If you're not going to let my people in, I'm not going to let your people in. And again, checking with the State Department to be sure that you can return from that country without having to quarantine. Some of the countries are now requiring verifiable, certified proof that you have had a test that you are coronavirus free, and that you would need to present that before or upon arrival in the country. And if you don't have that absolutely official attest, documentation, that you will not be allowed to come into the country. So all those things need to be very carefully addressed by Ron, and I would suggest that he speak with his travel agent or people who have planned the trip for him to be sure that all those I's are dotted and T's are crossed before he leaves home and takes that long trip to Malta. I'm sure he'll have a great time when he gets there. And things, it's a dynamic situation. For travel in August, September, things may change again. So it's good to keep checking the evolving situation. What's true today might not be true tomorrow or next week or next month.
Yeah, we may have to talk again in a month or so, but we only have a minute or so left. I want to thank both of you for being with us today. We've talked a little bit about air travel, talk about going in our cars. What about train? And people who decide to maybe take an Amtrak, one of those longer trips, is it safe to travel by train?
Well, Amtrak is currently posting that they have limited scheduling. They're also posting that their cafe service is available, food service on board, but it is only as carryout. They will not have seating in the cafe. And they're actually recommending that people take private rooms if they can do that for the longer distance trips on their trains that go greater distances. It would provide more comfort and more distancing and probably a sense of more safety and health.
Mm. So, Dr. Burkin, go ahead. What were you going to say?
One of the biggest factors in transmission is the amount of time that you're in an environment.
Uh-huh.
And so if the train ride is going to be lengthy, an air travel a flight might actually be safer given the filtration rate of a cabin, you know, even pre-COVID, and the amount of time that you might be on the plane. So I think the amount of time you would be in an enclosed space is really important to consider in making your travel plans.
It sounds like we still can have some fun on vacation this summer, but it's going to take a lot more preparation and a lot more thought, things which we didn't think about before. I want to thank both of our guests for being with us today. Craig Haberle is certified travel consultant with Central Penn AAA. Dr. Ashley Ritter, nurse practitioner and postdoctoral fellow at the University of Pennsylvania School of Nursing. Thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you, Scott.
Thanks so much.
Coming up tomorrow, we talk about fine particulate air pollution and what the American Lung Association wants the EPA to do. That's coming up on tomorrow's program.